Hello, you're listening to Russell Brand on Recovery, where we talk about the nature of addiction and the nature of recovery. Joining me today is my guest, Mark. Hello, Mark. Say your name and how long you've been clean.
Hello, my name is Mark, and I am now 20 years clean.
That's incredible.
Almost. Well, within 2 weeks, 3 weeks, yeah.
We never know, could be a relapse on the cards any moment for Mark. And
hope not.
Trevor?
Yeah, I'm Trevor, and I'm an alcoholic, and I've been clean 14 years.
Fantastic. And Anna?
I'm Anna, I'm an addict, and I've been clean 95 days.
Over the course of the next few minutes, we're going to be talking about the nature of our addiction, nature of our problem, and common solutions. And so really what I was hoping to do is to talk amongst the four of us about the issue of addiction and understand you, Mark, you work in addiction, is that right? You're a counsellor.
Yeah, so I'm a therapist and I'm based in Harley Street and...
Don't show off.
No. Okay, I'm based in central London.
Have you got an office there, or are you just sort of, are you on the
you
curb?
You should know, you've been in there. No, kidding on, yeah. But yeah, so I'm based there, and I've been based there for the last 7 years. And before that, I was working managing drug services in Hackney. And so I've been around working in the addiction field for a long time. But obviously, I'm also in recovery and got a lot of personal experience. And also, I'm from a family of addiction as well. I've been around a lot of addiction all my life, really.
Without wishing to be racist, it's bloody obvious from your accent. No, I'm joking. So what was it? Like, you grew up in Glasgow, did you?
So I grew up in Glasgow in the 60s. My father was an alcoholic, my grandfather was an alcoholic, my uncles were alcoholics, they were involved in a lot of crime as well, and that was sort of par for the course, really. But they, back then, they used to say, "Oh, we're just heavy drinkers. We work hard and we play hard." But in reality, there was so much denial, and they were justifying a lot of the behaviour. And so it was sort of endemic of Glasgow at that time too. It was, you know, obviously poorer city than in London. There's not so much opportunities, not so much employment, I guess people were depressed, and you know, but that's not the reason solely why they became alcoholics and addicts. There's a lot. It's much more complex than that, I think.
What about you personally? When did you first think I might be an addict?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, so I realised when I was about 22, 23 that I had a severe addiction problem. I'd went on from starting, you know, it's textbook progression really, smoking dope when I was a kid and stealing and all the other sort of behaviours, and obviously I was really sensitive as a child, hypersensitive. My mind wouldn't shut up, this incessant chatter that goes on as what we talk about, the illness, and low self-esteem, feeling really awkward, shy, and that's all the sort of backbone really of the addiction really. And then,
is that true, Mark, that you think that the backbone of this condition is not like our social deprivation in Glasgow in the 60s, but in fact the fact that you were a sensitive person whose mind wouldn't shut up? Is that really what you identify?
Yeah, and I think there probably is predispositions. I think there's predispositions where you have family, you know, like there's a perfect storm, isn't there? I think there's certain situations that happen, whereas somebody's really hypersensitive, but they've got access to drugs and alcohol, or they've got influences and the normalisation of drinking and drugging, really. And that contributes the hypersensitivity, and then the person just has to have access. And especially at a younger age, when they're 13, 14, and they first start taking chemicals, and it changes. And also we know that it's a dopamine deficit. You know, that the whole thing about it is, we know from the latest neuroscience that people with addictions produce less dopamine in the brain. So a lot of they talk about in various fellowships, they say about the restless and irritable discontent, those types of feelings are indicative of a lack of dopamine. There's a lack of meaning in life, the lack of purpose, and therefore when you take the chemical, you get the right amount of dopamine in the brain, which tells the brain, the midbrain, that, oh, I feel normal now. So, yeah.
Trevor, okay. what Mark was saying then about the his childhood,
yep.
feeling like sensitive and like his mind would never shut up, is that something that you recognise?
Yeah, I do. I do recognise that. And, for my experience is that I haven't met many alcoholic addicts who are not very sensitive, who are very intelligent, very articulate people. And I mean articulate and intelligent and sensitive through all parts of society. It's not discriminate. So very articulate people in deprived areas who articulate with the word F, but immensely articulate and sensitive too. And I completely agree with that comment. My background was not, was more subtle in terms of its the influences of addiction, but I certainly recall the family environment being a difficult environment, feeling separate from it, feeling
really
rather more sensitive. Yeah, absolutely. And
what sort of age are you talking about, Trevor?
It's always interesting. I don't much of a big book reader, but I always recall the phrase that you made a decision at a young
stand
age.
Stand this mic for me, mate.
I recall at the age of about 12, certainly making a decision that my parents really weren't very useful to me, and I would take my own counsel. And I hear that a lot, that people seem to have that common experience.
You felt very lonely, even at 12 years old, you felt a bit detached from your parents.
Felt detached from my family, that I didn't really belong to them, that I probably wasn't the child of my father. Not true, I am, absolutely.
Wow,
yeah.
So as a real little kid, you were living in your head a lot.
Yeah, absolutely so, yeah. To the extent that I would remove myself, I read a lot and fantasised a lot to escape those feelings in a way, yeah, I didn't feel part of. I felt I had to go my own way and make my own decisions at a younger age than 12. But 12, I recall it, definitely.
It's really curious that both of you have already mentioned a kind of a psychological precondition that's nothing at all really to do with drugs, other than Mark's reference to the fact that there is a dopamine deficit. Obviously, that's something where chemical addiction, you can see how that would play a part. But what I'm always struck by, and obviously with my own experience as an addict, is that what people are generally talking about is these feelings of sensitivity, inadequacy, loneliness and loss, and detachment. Anna, is that what do you recognize that?
Yeah, definitely. I think as a kid, my kind of earliest memory of feeling was of being like massively afraid. I was sort of a very frightened kid and very, very angry. You know, I kind of, there was lots of stuff going on, you know, in my home environment that I really couldn't deal with. I didn't have the tools to deal with. And I really feel like when I picked up drugs for the first time, that, you know, if I hadn't done that, if I hadn't found drugs, that I wouldn't have been able to survive what was happening. You know, it gave me a cloak to kind of wear over myself, to almost protect myself in a way. I felt, I was totally incapable of dealing with the outside world and everything that was happening to me as a kid. So, you know, drugs were the sort of buffer between me and the world.
Because what I've heard a lot when people talk about addiction is that addiction itself, the desire behind it, the drive behind it is legitimate, that what people are looking for is a sense of connection and a sense of wholeness. And as I've got older and spent and been in recovery for a while, I've started to recognise, I still feel that feeling of a longing and a yearning. So do you think, Anna, that the first time, like, what drugs were you taking, and what was the sort of state in your life around that time? How old were you, and what sort of took you there?
I started at a really young age drinking, sort of. So 9, I had my first drink. But the drug that really
seems bloody ridiculous.
It is a little bit ridiculous. The drugs that really sort of that gave me that feeling of safety, and I suppose, yeah, like you said, of connection, that something felt right for the first time, was really crack and heroin. So I started smoking crack when I was 13, and heroin just before my 14th birthday. And the first time I ever had heroin, I really did. I mean, they call it the ready, bret, glow, don't they? And it really did feel like that. Like someone had sort of wrapped me in a warm towel.
I mean, really, Breck's probably not that good for you, but there's some terrible additives in Ready Breck. Yeah, no, I'm sticking with heroin. It's ever such good stuff. Now, Mark, as a counsellor and manager working in the field of addiction, these experiences that Anna's describing, is that, do you find that to be quite uniform? Do most people describe those kind of feelings?
Yeah, absolutely. And what Anna was making reference to is that sensitivity too, that actually they feel, the person feels really raw without the drug or the alcohol when they take the drug or the alcohol. But it can also be, and what you're alluding to is other behavioural patterns as well. They have this sense of that it numbs them, it detaches them from that feeling. Now, that feeling of sensitivity. And of course, once they feel normal, they start to feel, once the dopamine levels have been peaked again and they feel normal, of course, what it does is it sends out a message to the memory in the midbrain, which says, remember this works, right? Which overrides the limbic system, which is saying there's a danger, because for the first time, the person's got enough dopamine in the brain, they feel normal. Ah. And once that connection, that neural pathway has been created between the midbrain, between the memory and the reward system, you're screwed, basically. Because then what happens is every time you take the drug, you've got the association, and that's where the powerlessness comes in.
That's brilliant. You can't overwhelm that once that connection's been made.
Once the connection's been made, that's it, you're screwed. And that's what they're able to see now, and that's why they're calling it a brain disease. Because,
that's interesting. Yeah. Now, one of the things that I've not mentioned about all four of us is that none of us now drink or take drugs at all, one day at a time. Is that true? Trevor, how long since you've drank or taken drugs?
Yeah, it's about 14 years now, coming up to 14 years since I had the last drink. Yeah, or drug.
And how have you been finding that?
Pretty good. I relapsed after about a year when I first entered a program and recovery. But after that, it's been fine. And today, actually, it's interesting because I don't think about drinking and I don't think about not drinking. And it has no attraction to me. I don't find I don't walk past bars in the summer and see people drinking and think, wow, I should be in there. I just feel that that's not for me. When I was first in recovery, I couldn't go to a disco and dance, and I didn't feel that I could talk very freely. But that didn't last too long. And actually, I can be the brightest person in a group of people without a drink these days.
What, you're living a normal life?
Absolutely.
Mind me asking, have you got a job and everything?
Yep, I got a job. In fact, I was listening to Mark earlier, and in fact, I was more of a slow burn. I didn't become addicted to substances or alcohol for a long, long time, but I was probably addicted to work very, very early.
That's interesting. What do you mean by that? What's the difference?
I don't know. I kind of got my rewards, I don't know, kind of got my pleasure, kind of got my fill, if you like, of something from working very hard. So I got some feeling of connection and belonging, feeling of security within a work environment,
Trevor,
rather than a family environment.
Absolutely, that's interesting. We've got to define, though, that addiction as having pejorative or negative consequence for it to qualify, because, like, you know, maybe you're just a hard-working guy who likes to crack on with his job. Unless it's like, what were the negative consequences of you working too hard?
Well,
how do you know, I'm addicted to work?
Well, I think it's because my relationships suffered, and I think one of the things I would say, and this may not be as relevant to this discussion as other people's contributions, but the family environment was a very difficult environment for me, and I didn't take to drinking to anaesthetize myself from that. I did take to books and things like that, and I do feel, or have felt, that my what pushed me into alcoholism was my difficulty with relationships. On the face of it, I would be the life and soul of the party and made easy relationships with women. But the term codependency isn't necessarily a clinical term, but I had a very difficult problem with relationships with women, and I used work to kind of escape the relationship with my wife to some extent, and that led to alcohol and drinking and so on.
I actually think that's incredibly important, because my understanding of addiction as I get into my own recovery is that what we call codependency is like the cornerstone, the foundation of the diseases. That like thinking about my own life, like, we know, because people that are like not addicts, maybe hear someone say, oh, I was a bit addicted to work or you know, reading books, and you think, well, so bloody what, just get on with it, get on with your job and read a bloody book then, what's the problem? Because I remember when Michael Douglas came out as a sex addict, you're like, get lost, what do you mean sex addict, you're a crafty little bastard, that's the problem. Mike, you know, like, so, but actually, like, from my own personal experience of addiction has been that the object of the addiction is less important than the impulses behind it. Now, like, at least I'm like picking up that both Mark and Anna are pretty sort of hardcore intravenous crack and smackheads. And like Trevor, it seems more like alcoholism, as it were. And with me, I sort of like I've floated around in the sort of what I call the second tier of non-intravenous heroin use and crack use, and like but it seems that all of us are talking ultimately about the condition. Now, one of Anna, how long have you not been drinking and using for?
Now it's 95 days.
That's amazing.
Oh, yes.
What have you noticed in that 95 days is hard for you?
I suppose what I noticed, and it's what I've noticed every time that I've got clean, probably.
Well, you got clean a lot of times, have you?
I have, yeah. I've relapsed a lot.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
I think because ultimately I've found living without drugs so painful that, you know, the consequences that I suffer as a result of my addiction, even though they're horrific and I know exactly what will happen when I use, it sort of becomes preferable to how I feel when I'm clean.
Wow, that's a pretty heavy thing to say, mate.
Yeah, especially, you know, knowing what my kind of consequences are and what my life is like in active addiction. I remember, you know, being clean the last time I was clean, and feeling that I had when I was a kid of being underwater and not being able to take breath, and I felt like the only thing that would sort of cause me to be able to breathe again would be to use again.
So it's like, actually for you, the condition of not having drugs feels like a deficit. It doesn't feel like the drugs is an addition. It feels like that is what is required for you to get to normal, to reach normal. You're not trying
Absolutely.
So now that you've got 95 days, how are you feeling?
Now I feel good. I'm kind of, it really is at the moment a kind of a day by day thing. I think what happens with me is, you know, people sort of question the disease aspect of things, but I really, really see the disease when I get clean. So when I put the drugs down, it almost feels like something inside me rears up, you know, that the force of the disease feels much stronger when I put the drugs.
What do you mean? What does
drugs...
it feel like?
So, I mean, I kind of compare it. There's a scene in Lord of the Rings where Kate Blanchett sees the ring in little Frodo's hand, and she sort of turns into this sort of overpowering demonic force. And I sort of feel like that's what happens when I get clean. I'm going to sound completely nuts now, but it feels like something inside of me is very angry that I have stopped using drugs. And
it feels like a secondary force that's in you wants them drugs.
Yeah, it does. And that's not absolving myself of responsibility. That's just, you know, that's what it feels like within sort of within my body and within my mind.
What do you reckon, Mark?
I think, it's really interesting too, what Anna said, because it is like having, it without sounding like a schizophrenic, it is like having
good luck.
You're never alone with a schizophrenic. But that thing where you've got this other personality, this sub-personality, and Freud talked about this years ago. He talked about the death drive and the life drive, didn't he? Thanatos and Eros, and he said that some people just have a lot more death drive, and it is like that part, that personality.
Death drive.
He called it a death drive. He called it Thanatos, like Thanatos and Eros.
Some Greek thing, is it?
He moved down. Anyway.
But what's the practical function of a death drive? Why would you have a death drive?
There's a guy called Kalcher, Donald Kalcher. I don't really know about him, Mark. But he has a very interesting theory that we kind of have three parts to us. There's a very wounded inner child, which we all know about a lot. But the death drive is, in fact, this insane sort of teenager, very angry character who's trying to protect the inner child.
Guy.
And he's the guy with the ego and the madness, and he's the one that's going to drink. And he means well. He's really trying to protect the inner child, but actually he overreacts to such an extent that he's a deathly force.
I'm just looking at the faces of the people, like, because I'm the only person here who's got people that I work with me. So when you talk about that teenager that's the overreactive, violent, volatile character, everyone around me is like trying not to make eye contact. Like with people that work I feel that feeling very strongly that something pulls me out, and it feels very righteous and very defiant and very certain, and I need it. Now, to think of something that is so psychological and abstract from chemical misuse or substance dependency, but is absolutely integral to it, is, I think, for people that are outside of addiction, a difficult thing to grasp. When Amy says that there's something in me that when I take the drugs away is very angry, I know that thing. I feel like there's some deficit I'm trying to make up the whole time. I'm looking at the world, I'm thinking, people are going to fuck with me, people are going to fuck with me, something's going wrong. And as soon as I sort of read the signal of that happening, like someone lets me down, someone does something I don't want to do, a woman is unable to meet my needs, it reminds me, bang, but I'm not in control no more, something happens to me, I become that guy.
I think everybody feels that. I think,
really?
Absolutely.
Addict or no addict.
I think everybody looks for safety and security. And once that's prejudice, once that's in danger, and we've started to feel fear, we reach for something, we fix for something. And if we start feeling those feelings, we start looking for something to make us feel better. It could be food, it could be shopping, it could be watching the telly, it could be whatever it might be. But it's getting your head out of there and getting your head into something else that doesn't feel that fear.
What does it want, this thing?
It wants expression, and what it wants, it looks for expression, doesn't it, in any particular area. And that's the thing. Jung said that the whole thing about addiction is that, and you talked about it at the beginning, was that what we're looking for is we're looking for connection. He just called it a spiritual malady, didn't he? He says
spiritual malady.
What's
said that supposed to mean?
Spiritual malady. That there's an emptiness, there's a vacuum inside that the person has. It's just like a vacuum, and they're looking, and it goes back to the roots of codependency, isn't it? What is codependency? The codependency is that we are always looking outside ourselves for something to fix us internally, whether it be a woman, whether it be a drug, whether it be work, whether it be gambling, where it could be spending, whatever the addictive process is. But as addicts, it is the human condition as well, but addicts have got an intensity and a regularity that is more so than your normal chap in the street, because they don't go out and self-destruct to the same degree as we do. They don't carry drugs through countries and borders, and they do various things that are just completely irrational. But for the addict, when they're in the full throes of their addiction, because there's no, that the rational mind, there's no thoughtful, considered decision making process going on, the addict's running the show.
When Anna described the experience of, like, why I, so when you're not with drugs, when you're not using, something kicks in. Like, what I think people might, like, have trouble understanding is the power of that. Now, like, the last, what, talk me through what happens to you when you're relapsing, and what are, even when drugs are not involved, what are the things that are going on with you? What happens?
Well, I suppose I was just thinking, you asked, you know, what does that thing want? And Mark was talking about, you know, the need to kind of fix yourself. What I've found when I've been clean is that it's my kind of, the ways that my addiction manifests itself have never, ever really been things that fix or comfort me. I suppose I get a kind of a comfort from them, but it's always been this need to destroy myself. I don't know where it comes from, but it's incredibly overpowering. You know, my addiction will manifest itself in self-harm, you know, sort of starving.
You do that, do you? Self-harming?
Yeah, I mean, not anymore, but I did do in a pretty serious way.
Does it feel like you want to do that more when you're not using?
Absolutely.
So this is, you feel, and then what other behaviours? How's your eating or your relationships when you're not using drugs? What happens?
Yeah, I mean, my relationships are kind of non-existent when I'm clean. I mean, my sexual relationships are non-existent when I'm clean, because I sex worked when I was using, so I kind of have, like, I keep myself very separate when I'm clean. My food is horrendous. I mean, I find it very difficult to get a balance, so I'm either not eating anything or eating far too much. So
your whole nature is completely subsumed and consumed by this condition, from whether it's your sexuality, your diet. There is nothing that is not affected by it.
Yeah, it feels that way, yeah. Well, and the evidence would show me that that's true, yeah.
Yeah, that it just, it, like, and I suppose in a more, somewhat more pedestrian way, like, I don't, like when I first got clean, like the transition to being totally obsessed with, like, I need to have sex, I need to be have, I can't be on my own, I need to have women around me, I can't be, like it was, there was no rational or mental component to it, if you know what I mean. It was like a drive that was like tidal. I just was like, there you go, you're straight in that. And it took me about 10 years to even though, like, day dot, it was bloody obvious. People are going, what's he doing? You're like an obsessive lunatic. This is mental. You can't live like this. 10 years before I had the ability to go, right, I want to do something about this, because this similarly is detaching me. Like, even though it's like obviously a lot worse to be a crack and heroin addict than it is to be addicted to sexual behaviours. In the end, I found myself in the same place of sort of despair, loneliness, self-loathing, and also having negative consequences on other people's lives, because obviously I was getting involved in relationships with people that were detrimental and harmful. And it seems sort of comparable in a way to what Anna is saying about diet affected, sex affected, like that. Oh, you know, and because, and as both Mark and Trevor have indicated, that thing's in there and it wants summit.
But it would take 10 years to come through that, because if you're anything like me, I talked to you earlier about, you know, at the age of 12, deciding to do things my own way. Well, the other side of that was I was actually gathering evidence for resentment against the people I felt that had alienated me, my family. So I spent much more than 10 years gathering those resentments and building this massive case as to, I mean, I didn't realise at the time, but looking back on it, I can see that clearly, that how I became the victim. And in fact, all of my drinking and all of the other behaviours were a form of self-harm. I was actually trying to draw attention to the massive pain that I'd created inside me. God. So it was all self-harming. All of that was self-harming, looking back on it. Yeah.
It's really sad.
Utterly sad, yeah, absolutely.
But also the thing is here, Russell and guys, is that it's really difficult to emotionally regulate, right, when you first get clean and sober, right? So the big thing here is that if you've spent, you know, if it's taken you 20 years to get into the woods, it's going to take you a long time to get back out of those woods, because it's like, you know, you get clean and you've got all your feelings back. We talk about it all the time, don't we? Like, you get clean and you get all of these feelings, these intense feelings, plus you've got the sensitivity, you've got that hypersensitivity that you felt when you were 14 or 13 years old, which started the whole process of you using. So how do you deal with those emotions? How do you manage to get mechanisms to emotionally regulate? We don't know, because nobody's telling us. I mean, when we go to fellowships, we learn because we hear other people talking about, oh yeah, I do this, I go for, you know, I go and I do yoga, or I do meditation, or I go and talk to friends. We start to develop the tools, but it takes a while to develop the tools. Hence why they say, you know, we need to get connected. We need to get connected with people right at the beginning so that we're not isolated.
You think human connection is an integral antidote to this condition?
Massive. Yeah, massive.
Anything other than being inside your own head with your own thoughts is what it takes. And just a tiny scrap of that can get you stopped.
When I wake up in the morning, pretty much every day, like, I wake up now, you know, in a house that I love, and like next to a woman that I love who's 8 months pregnant. Yeah. I feel basically like, well, fuck this. That's like the first thing I think every day. Not in a specific way to the conditions, but my just general feeling on wakening is like, ugh, right, okay. Like, and like, what's that? What's going on there? Is that, what are you feeling like? You're 95. So far. Like, Mark, how long have you been clean, mate?
On the 4th of December, I'll be 20 years clean
well
and
done,
sober.
Well done, Blue Peter badge. Trevor, you said 14 years. I'm coming up to 14 years. December, please God, one day at a time. 95 days, right? So it's for you. And like at different times, you've been clean sober for like, what, a year?
Yeah, I had 19 months just before the last relapse.
It's amazing. And like, well done. So sort of presumably you can do it. And also you've got like a lot of experience, as you've said, of the consequences of it. What, like when you're waking up, like in today, for example, when you wake up, you know you're coming in here to do this podcast. What goes on in your head?
At the moment, I'm getting the breathlessness feeling quite a lot. I mean, I spoke like my... I'm in a treatment centre at the moment. My counsellor calls it a panic attack, something that I've not kind of experienced to that intensity before. To, you know, I had the feeling of not being able to breathe, but, you know, now it's sort of manifesting itself in a really physical way. And I mean, I don't sleep very well, and I sort of never have, but, like, when I'm making it sound awful. I mean, I love being clean, and I have a sense of freedom, you know, in amongst all of that other stuff. But yeah, I do. I have my anxiety is quite high at the moment, and I don't know.
You feel frightened, yeah, anxiety. Yeah. You wake up and you feel frightened, and yeah, you have sort of panicky feelings.
Yeah, like I did when I was a kid, I suppose.
Wow, really? You still feel like that? So, like, we're people that sort of like. We work abstinence-based recovery programs. Yeah. So, like, as you've indicated, we attend fellowships that are bound by traditions and that we have to respect and observe. Like, so, like, when you as a counsellor, a fella with approaching 20 years, you hear, like, Anna say, right, I wake up, I'm anxious. Do you identify with that? And do you think that the way that you've stayed clean is applicable to Anna and other people that are, like, listening to this and sort of thinking, hang on a minute, I do look at bloody social media too much. I am obsessed with spending money. Yeah. I'm looking at too much pornography, or indeed, I'm a crack and heroin addict, where it should be plainly obvious that there is a severe problem, son. Yeah. What do you think that the thing that works for you, do you think it works for anybody? Because I think one of the things people say about abstinence-based recovery is it's too hard.
No, they say that. But the problem is, if you're an addict, if you've got an addictive personality and you don't embrace abstinence, complete abstinence, you can't do any work on the root issue. The problem is, we have to get clean and sober and stop the acting out so that we can actually see the illness.
Yeah.
We can't see it when we're still acting out. If I'm still just right in the midst of the thing. And so, and what Anna was saying to it, I really relate. That doesn't see those thoughts. And you too, Russell, you says, I wake up and you've got your beautiful wife, beautiful girlfriend, or fiance, and you're. And,
it's only one woman, by the way.
It's one woman.
Beautiful wife, my fiance,
Three of them in the bed.
Oh, that's not enough.
But of course, we do. And that's why, upon awakening, we've got to take, because we wake up with the illness in the morning, because that's what we've always had. The illness has always been, it's been there for a long, long time. We have an intimate relationship with our illness. It's always been there. So the whole idea is that it's like a game of chess. We have to be one step ahead of the illness all the time. So we have to be equipped with the tools to understand how it processes, how it thinks.
So what's the first bit then, mate? It's all right for you. You've clocked up the score of decades. What's the first bit?
Well, the first bit, right, the first bit is, it's like, for example, with Anna, if she's freaked out in the morning, when she wakes up, it's really good for her to do some meditation or just to connect right away with somebody that understands, that somebody that she can talk to who can empathise, who understands her condition, that she feels that she's out of the isolation, that she can start and feels that she can get hope from another individual, but also then just not to act out. I mean, the thing is, just not to act impulsively, just to know all the time that no matter, even if you're craving, you don't have to act out on the craving.
But that craving doesn't require action.
No, you don't. You don't have to. You don't have to act. It's like a wave that hits a beach. Like the wave gets bigger and bigger, and then it hits the beach, and then it dissipates. It's the same with cravings. If you can just stop yourself from acting out, it will eventually diminish. And if you can do some of the Buddhist stuff or the mindfulness stuff and just observe it and not. I mean,
sometimes feels a bit bloody flimsy though, doesn't it? The old Buddhism.
I know.
When the craving kicks in.
I know.
Just watch it, because sometimes I feel like I could float off on that wave, soar off on that wave. What do you think, Trevor? What do you think, like the on awakening, that beginning bit when you're tackling it, early days?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, the interesting thing for me is when I first wake up and I haven't started thinking, I'm okay. It's only when I start thinking that it kicks in, I'm still me.
And it's to do with thoughts.
This is very difficult. Yeah. So it's about being in my head, and I love that analogy about the wave and sitting through it, staying present. I mean, to me, the Buddhist stuff really helps, mindfulness really really help anything not to be thinking. So
don't think.
Absolutely. Right. Not thinking. And we all think we have to think about everything. Well, we don't. I mean, I'm sure we drive our cars without thinking about driving very much. Maybe we shouldn't, but we do. We can digest food. We can breathe. We can get over almost everything. And actually, not the best ideas
That's
in the world ever.
That's a profound thing to come out with,
Trevor.
Well,
I don't know, but I think it,
well, it bloody is. You're saying we've got to avoid thinking. Well, I don't think That's all I've done all morning.
I think it helps. I don't think we need... We can't think ourselves out of this problem. We can't.
So that is a spiritual... What you're saying there, mate, that's an esoteric spiritual idea that, like, the thought is the first layer of the material world. You've sort of delved into it with thoughts. Because when... Actually, you're spot on. Because when I wake up, it's like... It's not the sensation of the sheets that's bothering me. No. It's I think a thought. I go, this probably isn't what should be happening. Life should be better than this. What's going on? Yeah. Like that. So some sort of thing kicks in.
Yeah.
And it's like, what's that? You know, like, so like, the even though it sounds a bit sort of flaky, like, oh, you know, you've got to learn to meditate, detach from your thoughts. Actually, that has got an integral part to play, but it can't happen without the support and connection to other people. That is absolutely integral.
Well, there's a couple of things you could do. I mean, just standing back for a second and just saying, what am I thinking, is enough to detach from being possessed by the thought. So just not getting on the thought train and trundling down the hill in the train isn't that difficult. You can say, I don't need to be going now. You can hear, feel the signs inside your head. You know, your heart beats fast, you're starting to being anxious. Just stop. Say, hang on, what am I doing? What's this about?
Yeah. Do you have to get someone on a blower to stop?
Yeah, that's a very good idea. Certainly an early recovery. Actually thinking about someone worse off than you and trying to help them is a fantastic way of getting
away. I usually think about Mark.
As long as it's not in the shower.
So, Anna, now what about you as a person with 95 days, which is actually an incredible achievement. I remember 90 days, that means I'm just out of treatment. I'm a brittle little man in a flat that my friends are paying for me, terrified and scared and nervous, like, but still then I've got a lot to offer to people that have got, like, that, you know, that haven't stopped at all. Particularly, it's like, you know, you've already indicated you've suffered pretty heavy consequences as a result of your using, right?
Yeah.
Are you comfortable talking about the extremity of that?
Yeah.
All right. So Mark, I'm imagining, has done a little bit of bird in his time.
Oh yeah, I've done some. Done some time. Sure.
Mark's been behind the door. Trevor, I'm guessing that me and you are there. We've not been in prison.
I had a night in a police station, which was probably
right. Yeah, me as well, Trevor. That doesn't count. No. These two aren't going to let us get away with that.
No, we're lightweights.
Unless you've at some point injected heroin into a hemorrhoid, these two think that you're some sort of Lord Fauntleroy with an occasional woodbine. Anna, I know you've done a lot of prison sentences, haven't you? You've already said yourself that your disease is involved having to do sex work. You're in a very unique position to address people that would seem to be in insurmountable trouble.
I guess so. I mean, I was in treatment one of the many times I've been in treatment. 3 years ago, in a place in London, and at that time I think I probably was at the lowest that I've been, and I was physically, mentally, emotionally absolutely fucked. And am I allowed to swear?
Yeah.
You swore earlier.
Yeah.
I mentally I was really, really ill. You know, I was hearing voices, I was having like visual hallucinations, and self-harming a lot. So I was clean, I'd done my detox, and the self-harm just sort of took off. And this girl came into the treatment centre. She was a young girl, only 16 at the time. I think they had to change the insurance to the treatment centre for her to come in. Mm. And she changed my life.
How?
She made it so that everything that had happened to me and everything that I'd been through, instead of being this sort of mess of horror, became something that was worthwhile and that had a purpose. You know, I fell in love with this girl. I mean, she was sort of everything to me. And I think it just, you know, like you were saying, that the ability, I never knew that I had the ability to care for somebody else in that way at that time. And it sort of, not only did it make everything that I had been through have a purpose, but it gave me a purpose as well. You know, me at that time, it sort of gave me something to get up for. It stopped me sitting and sort of wallowing in all the stuff that I was going through, you know, because I had to be there for her. And I think for her, you know, having talked to her sort of in more recent times, for her knowing that I had been through the things that she was going through, knowing that, you know, I had those experiences, she found it very difficult to talk to anyone else. And I think, you know, that is something that we, I think as women as well and as girls, you know, I'm not discounting anything that anyone else has gone through, but it's a very different experience to be able to talk to a woman about the things that we go through in addiction, because, you know, not that we suffer in a worse way, but we suffer in different ways. And sometimes, in, you know, I've found abstinence-based recovery to be quite a male-dominated world. Yeah. You know, the same as out there in addiction, it feels like a very male-dominated world. And being able to speak to a woman that's come through the things you have, you know, for me, and I know for her, you know, was my salvation, really.
Your salvation came from compassion and connection, because it provides, I suppose, a transcendent comparable to what the behaviour and chemical can provide. It takes you literally out of yourself and gives you a focus outside of yourself. So it's important, isn't it, to acknowledge that your future recovery will necessarily involve that kind of compassion. And I know for me, my natural tendency is total self-obsession. That self-obsession for me. Like, if I'm not distracted from just thinking about myself, sometimes it'll get to about 3 or 4 o'clock and I'll sort of go, hold on a minute, all I thought about all day is what I want, what I'm happy with, what I'm not happy with, what there should be more of. And like, although that is sort of unpleasant, it's more importantly lethal, because it is one of the building blocks of my self-destruction. And that is impossible to underestimate the significance of this. It's really kind of, we're talking about love, of being loving and useful.
Yeah, absolutely.
To other people.
Good word to use. Yeah, I mean, I just agreeing with that and empathising with it, and it applies to men too. It's not just women. But for me, what I'm doing
she was very clear about that.
Yeah, she was. Yeah. What comes to me is that although I can be compassionate and care for someone else, it's very difficult for me to do that about me and my inner child. But in looking after someone else, actually, I'm in some way relating to my inner child, my wound, my hurt. So if I can't do it directly for myself, I can do it through someone else. And it's very important that I can do that.
And that's really important too, is how you identify, because when we hear somebody else's pain, we immediately identify, because their wound is our wound as well. Yeah. And that's why when we are being compassionate to someone else, we're being compassionate to ourselves. Yeah. And that's vital. That altruism is vital.
I mean,
it
literally happens now, don't it? I mean, like when you were talking then, Anna, I'm feeling that feeling of, oh God, I just want her to be all right. I've got to make sure she's okay. Like, I feel like in that moment, I'm not thinking, I think I probably might like a haircut. Like, you know, like a sort of, it takes me out of it. And it is important, like, you know, I say, you know, that Trevor, what you're saying is that, like, sort of we as men with our, like, it's interesting how gender identity plays a role in this, because, like, obviously I can't ever understand what issues a woman goes through in addiction or in broadly speaking, any other bloody situation. But, like, but men also carrying these sort of superimposed roles. I heard this wonderful quote. This quote, it comes from the non-alcoholic legal secretary of the Alcoholics Anonymous 12-step fellowship. This excuse me just while I find it. This guy said, oh, look, I think that Bernard Smith, the non-alcoholic legal representative of AA, came close to the mark when he said the alcoholic was never enslaved by alcohol. Alcohol simply served as an escape from personal enslavement to the false ideals of a materialistic society. The member was never enslaved by alcohol. Alcohol simply served as an escape from personal enslavement to the false ideals of a materialistic society. Yeah. So, like, that really sort of resonates with me, because I feel like when this feeling of anger, frustration, sensitivity that we've all talked about in our early lives, is a sort of sense of, like, this isn't working. What is this thing? It doesn't make sense. And then so as soon as something comes along, like you described, Mark, as a sort of a dopamine peak provided by substance or some other form of escape, that becomes salvation. So it is, in fact, a kind of spiritual experience that's a self-generated spiritual experience, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And then you can't help but reinforce it. As soon as you start to do it, because of what's happened in the reward system and the memory, you keep on doing it over and over again. But your rational mind, I think we're nearly finished now, you tell yourself, oh no, then the denial and the rationalisation and all those sort of mechanisms that sustain the addiction get set up. And then years go past, as we know, and we come out of it, hopefully, in one piece by finding some type of programme or we go to rehab or whatever we do, but then we come back out and we have liberation and freedom, but then we've got to maintain it by not going into some other form of addiction.
What I find very reassuring is that through connection and compassion and such sort of obvious building blocks of a different type of life, to use a sort of a word that sometimes carries a sort of a film of hippie negativity, a sort of a spiritual life, that there is a solution in that. That I find that astonishing. And spiritual, I suppose, put more prosaically, connection, kindness, being open to other people, being loving. There is a practical and pragmatic solution. That's all we've got time for today. Mark, thank you very much for sharing
pleasure,
with us.
Pleasure.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Trevor, also very kind of you to share with us. And thank you, Anna. It's really lovely to hear from you. Well done today.
Thanks, Ross.
We will be talking more about recovery on Russell Brand on Recovery sometime soon. Thank you very much.